if you say, yeah, I do believe that, then that automatically launches you into an entirely new set of thinking and internal debate and debates with your associates, etc.
Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. My name is Nicholas Underwood. On this episode, I had the extraordinary opportunity to sit down with one of the most noted strategists in U.S. Air Force history, Colonel Retired John Warden. Colonel Warden is credited as the architect of the Desert Storm Air Campaign, which was based on his revolutionary concept of the enemy as a system. Our conversation centers around the strategy of the United States and China, and how we should fundamentally change the way we think about the U.S. homeland as a sanctuary, what it means to be a peer competitor, the concept of time during a conflict, and decisive geography. Please join us. So, Colonel Warden, thank you so much for being here. This is incredible. Your work has influenced me and entire generations. So for you to continue to come and give your time for us, I'm incredibly humbled. So thank you for being here before I ask anything else. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure.
Sir, so we've given your bio kind of in our introduction, but you had significant contributions to the air component efforts, both throughout the Gulf War, leading up to the Gulf War, post-Gulf War, a lot of instruction. And so during that time, your book, The Air Campaign, talks a great deal about changing our mindset and how we think in general about how to use air power. And as we now listen to the CSAF for the last 8 years, the SECAF just on Monday started saying, hey, we're out of time. We got to start analyzing this problem. It's a complex problem. And so here in doctrine, we are updating our command and control doctrine. We're putting out a planning doctrine that gets into design and planning activities to better emphasize these. But it occurs to me that when you go into planning, when you go into strategy, when you go into design, the lens in which you look through can be vastly altered depending on what your past experience is or what you think, I'll say, what a lot of the assumptions look like. As someone who continues to look at this problem, I'd like to ask you, how are you looking at the challenges that lay in front of us? And how do you generally approach analyzing these kind of problems? And are these old challenges, these new challenges? What do they look like?
I think I would have to say that there is a combination of old and new challenges that are out there. And they actually can oppose each other. And by that, what I mean is that the problem of thinking about strategy and how you're going to win wars, that goes back to Alexander the Great and a little bit before then, although we don't know very much about the details of anything prior to Alexander, unless you want to talk about the Trojan War, which actually is some pretty good stuff in that. Some of that stuff is the same problems that Alexander had, except that they're very similar in a lot of different ways. The old part of the thing is kind of related to how you were introducing. People tend to think about problems from their own experience. Your own experience from a military standpoint is normally the tactical experience that you had, whether it was riding a horse or flying an airplane or whatever, and you carry that up with you as you are promoted. And at some point, the fact that you're a pretty darn good horseman doesn't have a darn thing to do with how you're going to organize and employ forces. But it is almost impossible from a human perspective to push that stuff aside and say, yeah, it was interesting. I like the horses, but they're no longer relevant and there's a completely different problem and I need to think in a different way. So from that standpoint, there's a lot of old stuff that is utterly relevant. And on the other hand, that there's from a personal standpoint, that there is new stuff, your own experience, that is not only no longer relevant, but in fact, it's counterproductive. Wow. And this is extraordinary challenges. I have obviously done a lot in military and service and Air Force, but also have done almost as much time working in the civilian world with businesses and teaching strategy and so on and so forth. And you see exactly the same problems. Very capable guys become CEOs, but their capability, they got there because they were wonderful salesmen or a great research guy or whatever it may happen to be. And there was no question about that. But when they got up at the top, that their basic solution to the company problems was, well, the answer clearly is, if I came up through sales, our sales guys are not doing as much as this. We need more sales guys. We need better training, whatever it happens to be. And that ability to think about things in a different way is a challenge. I think it's especially a challenge because when you're starting, you're problems are tactical. How do I do this? And how it's a mechanical kind of a thing in many ways. When you get up to the top, it's strategy. And strategy is sort of an unnatural thing. Hmm. We don't do strategy as human beings because our survival has depended on being very good at the tactical. Tiger leaps out of the bush at you. You need to deal with the tiger. Right. And you think of the highest that you ever get in strategy is, well, I know tigers live over there, so I'm not going there anymore. So, yeah. But it's not something we do every day. We don't teach the strategy, I think, that we teach in our military schools and the business schools, too, is an amalgamation of tactical kinds of things as opposed to strategy as a different world and thinking about things from a different direction.
It's a lot about, and I'm going to overly simplify what you say, and I apologize, but a lot about biases and assumptions being made at the higher level. And so I think about it, is there a template? If I go, okay, my template that I've seen is a soft guy, it's counterinsurgency. So I know that template's not right. Do I have a template in American history that I can kind of look at to help me better understand this? Is there anything out there?
This is another significant problem of where we are right now. And that is that the last template that we had for the kind of problem that we're facing now was when the British came ashore in 1811 or something like that, and then promptly burned Washington, et cetera. We don't think very much about that, and things have changed an awful lot. So the template we have is the template you just described. Well, we're going to go to Iraq, and we're going to do this special operations stuff and so on, and we'll go drop some bombs on some guys and some very precise things to kill this guy. And, well, how about World War II? That was a pretty big thing. Well, the template for World War II is, okay, so the Japanese attacked us, and now we're pretty mad at them. We were starting to get a little bit mad anyway, so we'd started a buildup, and we just accelerate the buildup, and they're over there, so we'll pull everything together, and we'll go there and beat them up. We'll kill them, and we'll do the same thing to the Germans. We'll have to do the Germans first for whatever reason, but it was pretty straightforward. It was the template. We're going to assemble this massive stuff, and we're going to go over there, and we're going to do whatever we want to do to the Japanese and the Germans, or maybe some tough getting there initially, but we'll get there, and we'll win. That can still be the template at a very high level, but the significant difference, I think, even between World War II and what we're facing now, is the fact that neither the Germans nor the Japanese nor anybody preceding them had the ability to interfere at all with the homeland. We could do anything we wanted here and within complete safety, and there was simply no issue. Since the British burned Washington, as a country, the United States, we have never faced that issue. We thought about it a little bit, but we never had to face it. It was never a serious problem. It's interesting, however, that in the Civil War, that the North fought the victors, fought that war exactly the same way, basically in a strategically safe location, manufacturing in the North and Northeast, pretty good manpower capability. We'll assemble it, and then we'll blockade the South, and then we'll go destroy their capability, which then ends up with the march that came right through here, or pretty darn close to here, when Sherman went to the sea. And that march to the sea was not merely to take a little bit of a hike, but it was to destroy infrastructure, cotton, ammunition plants. In fact, one of the interesting but small battles that took place was actually at Selma, where there was a very significant munitions factory, cannon factory, and so on and so forth. So that was an objective. So the North, and of course the victors then were the ones that carried on the majority of the doctrine, if you will, they had that as the template. So we have a template now, which has served us well as long as the conditions were such that secure homeland, plenty of build-up time, nobody else can do anything to us. But when you move into a world where you have a peer competitor, and a peer competitor, very simply, is somebody that can do exactly the same thing you can do to him as he can do to you. Could we bomb China? You bet. Can China bomb us? You bet. Will China bomb us? You bet. Especially if we bomb them. But if we don't bomb them, then we got a really serious problem. Thinking through that is a completely new set of thinking that we need to go through.
the peer competitor. We use the term great power competition quite a bit, and near peer and our closest adversary. We're very careful about the peer terminology. And I don't think anybody's ever quite defined it, but that very simple definition of whatever you could do to them, they can do to you, I think really starts to tear at the away game mentality that we have. Now, doctrinally, we're always on the offensive. We're always trying to regain the offensive, and it's an offensive mindset at all times. But I think sometimes that gets translated into an away game mentality, or we're going to deploy. And that's quite interesting. We spoke recently with General Minahan, and we talked about exploding into theater. One of the challenges is always is getting into theater. But what you're talking about is we may not be able to assemble to depart due to a lot of disruption. And I think that is one of the big mental shifts that you're trying to get at.
I didn't see it. I don't even know whether it was recorded, but I saw a summary of what apparently General Alvin talked a little bit about at the Denver thing, in which he actually said, hey, we can no longer depend on having absolutely safe bases here. And I think he said it in the context of the division of responsibility between a wing commander, the fighting stuff, and a base commander.
Right.
And he said the base commander may be significantly responsible for defending against actual threats right here in the United States. So we can no longer absolutely depend on having that security here. Now, I don't know quite what the context was. I didn't see a transcript of what he said, but that was the first time I've heard anybody in a position of authority that make that comment about threats to CONUS bases. Mm-hmm. So how far he went with that, what the further discussion and where it came from, I'm not quite sure. The other thing I wanted to mention was the choice of vocabulary becomes extraordinarily important. And I don't think that there's any problem at all in talking about great power competition if you're talking about great power competition more in a geopolitical sense, because the great power competition probably hadn't changed very much since the Concert of Europe, before that, and so on and so forth. I think one of the contentious issues over Ukraine is not so much the issue of the actual fighting there. What is your objective in Ukraine? And from a great power standpoint, people can and have made the point that fighting in Ukraine has a side effect of driving another great power that's involved in that, driving the Russians into a coalition or some kind of cooperation, greater cooperation with the Chinese. So you could end up winning maybe in Ukraine. But if the cost of winning in Ukraine was to create a functioning alliance between Ukraine and China, you might say maybe that wasn't such a good deal. Mm-hmm. So when you're thinking about this stuff, the diplomacy, which military really needs to have more of a say in that than it does, or more of an input in any of that, you got to think about, okay, we can go fight somebody here. But what is the consequence of fighting these people here in terms of these people over here?
Right.
The Middle East is a good example. Everything we do in the Middle East, nothing is simple there. Your ally Israel does Gaza. And what does that do? Well, it creates a lot of reactions in Saudi Arabia and in Iraq and so on and so forth. So how do you balance that stuff? And that really is a great power situation. But the actual fighting part of it, that the peer war, really thinking about that, I don't care about near peers. We can deal with near peers any day of the week. And anything below that, I think we can still do okay. But the peer war, because of this idea that if we can do it to them, they can and probably will do it to us, is something that we have simply not grasped, I don't think.
No, that's good. Let's just go into the comparison there. One of the ways, we're not going to get into capability specifically here, but I think we can look at a large picture. And so when one of the doctrinal ways to sit down and begin this kind of mission analysis is comparing two forces, you use a force space time acronym, and you kind of look at the force, which is the capabilities to influence the other, to affect the other, the space, typically a geography, not solely limited to land, but looking across the entire space of how the forces are arranged. We really get into the operational stuff there. And then time, the time I have to act. And that could be influenced both politically, that can be influenced socially from home state, or that could also be considering how quickly we act and how that affects different things. And I know that China has certainly dissolved some lessons there from other wars. So looking at the force, as we compare the two forces, what are some big things that you're pulling out of that in this peer realm?
So we have fought a war with China once before. That was the Korean War. Hmm. And at that time when we fought that, the current Chinese government was only 2 years, 3 years of being in power from 1949. They had basically a land army that they had used to overcome the opposition and win in China. And that's what they took to Korea, augmented by some fighters and so on, some help from the Russians, direct help. But they were basically fighting a land war. And we decided to fight a land war, too, because we made a decision very early on in the war, like about just after the Chinese incursion in November, December of 1950, we drew a line on the Yalu River and said, we will not go across that line. So here are the Chinese, then they're sitting behind basically the wall of the Yalu that went up to infinity, and we couldn't go across it. And so that meant that they could pull all of their, they had at the time probably 500, 600 million people compared to the time we were probably 200 million, maybe 150. So they could put all those people right up to the Yalu and then feed them across in a whole variety of places, walk across the Yalu 4 or 5 months out of the year, or 3 or 4 at any rate, when the river was frozen, otherwise bridges and so on and so forth. But when we could bomb bridges, but only the Korean side of the bridges. So we fought an attrition war with them. And although we managed to keep them from winning, it sure was expensive. Mm-hmm. We lost almost 50,000 people and ended up exactly where we had started 3 years previously. It doesn't make much sense. At that time, China was not a peer competitor. And we could do anything we wanted. We could have won that war probably in 2 or 3 months or less. We had the capability if we were willing to shut down China in one form or another. So we weren't a peer competitor. Now, if there was another replay of Korea, I don't think that you could remotely think about the idea that the Chinese were not going to attack the United States. I mean, clearly that they recognized the enormous advantage they had in the Korean War by being immune from attack against China itself. And they have now had the advantage of seeing what we have done to other people, what we did in World War II and the Gulf and other places, and the value of that, what that does if you are under aerial attack. Aerial attack is the wrong way to use it. That was a very significant part of it. But the defeat of both Germany and Japan, I think, is better to say not because of aerial bombardment, but because of strategic attack. Mm-hmm. And so strategic attack was a combination of basically shutting down the internal functioning of both Germany and Japan, but also the strategic attack was preventing them from getting the kinds of material they needed. Mm-hmm. And it was especially obvious in the case of Japan, where the blockades, which were done largely by the Navy, but not exclusively at all, that combination of cutting them off from their supplies on the one hand, and on the other hand, making life pretty much unsustainable in Japan itself, that strategic attack won the war. Mm-hmm. And it happened to be assisted significantly by people fighting on the surface to get air bases and so on, because the range of the equipment and so on. But there was never any question whether we were going to succeed or not. It was a given. And in fact, that the Japanese, Yamamoto, knew that. He said that right up front. He said, we got 6 months after Pearl Harbor. He said, I can do anything I want. I can wander around the Pacific. But if we haven't won, meaning if the United States has not pulled out of the war, we're doomed. We've lost. And 6 months later, we not only had not pulled out, but we were on a very effective offensive. And we had already won a great naval battle. And the rest is history.
So that's not a good example of a peer.
It's not a good example, peer, not even remotely a peer. Now, however, if you sort of flip that thing, you say, okay, do the Chinese have the ability to attack the United States? Well, there's another interesting corollary question is, what is our ability to attack China? And you all know that heck of a lot better than I do. I'm not confident about it. Mm-hmm. Do the Chinese have the ability to attack the United States? I don't know what their capability is in terms of execution, but in terms of just force structure, they clearly do. I think one of the most dramatic things that has happened within the last, well, some months, was that Chinese hypersonic missile that flew around the world landed back in China pretty close to its designated target. We don't have that kind of capability. Do they have 1,000 of those things? I don't think so. But one of the lessons I think that should have come out of the Gulf War, and I think it did, the Gulf War and subsequent wars, was the value of precision. And the value of precision is not so much that you can do things with less bombs and less stuff, but it means that if there is some critical part of an opponent, that you can now hit that and take that out. Mm-hmm. So it to sort of bounce back and forth between various operations. If you think about the World 1943 and 8th Air Force attacks on Germany, the attacks on the ball bearing plant at Schweinfurt were enormously expensive and did a lot of damage, but it had almost none of the impact that it was expected to have. Well, was that because ball bearings weren't important? No, it wasn't. It was because that we didn't understand what the inventory of ball bearings was, and the fact that ball bearings also came from Sweden and some other places like that. And then on top of that, we dropped an awful lot of bombs on the Schweinfurt convoy. Relatively few of those bombs did any serious damage. In today, rather than sending 500 B-17s, you send theoretically one B-21 or B-2 or something like that, and it hits the three or four machines in Schweinfurt that were genuinely vital and were very, very difficult to replace. And so Schweinfurt could have been shut down for months and months as opposed to a few weeks. Did the Chinese have the capability to fly a hypersonic missile and hit a point target in the United States? And the answer is maybe. But interestingly, that their strategic attack capability is not at all limited to missiles or airplanes or something of that sort. So if they want to shut something down, they can shut the electricity down probably through a combination of things, but primarily by cyber attack in one kind or another. But that's not all. They also clearly have pretty good biological warfare capability. So if you make all of the guys that fix power lines and so on, if you make a bunch of those guys sick, why, that doesn't shut it down by itself, but it helps along with the cyber attack. Over 20,000 Chinese nationalists crossed the border, the southern border, within the last couple of years. 20,000, and those significantly military-aged, unaccompanied males. So what is their role? Well, fifth column, sabotage, infiltration, all of the above, probably almost certainly. So when you think about the Chinese strategic attack capability against the United States, it's pretty interesting. I don't really know exactly how it compares to ours, but again, if we go back to sort of that definition, a working definition of a peer competitor is anybody can do basically the same thing to you that you can do to him. I don't think we have a biological warfare capability. I don't know whether we have a balloon fleet, other things like that. But we do clearly have an ability to attack into China, and China clearly has the ability to attack into us.
One of the things that was most significant, we jump in and out of World War II, it wasn't just the U.S.'s capabilities in terms of the technology. In fact, when we showed up, we were a little behind. What we were able to do is to continue to throw technology, throw airmen, soldiers, sailors into the fight. We were able to bring that mass together and then sustain it. And so there's a lot of discussion now about the vulnerabilities of the military-industrial complex and whether or not we can continue to produce these high cost, high complex machinery over and over again at a high rate. Obviously, a balloon is very simple to do for the Chinese, and I've seen we've decided to use a $500,000 missile to shoot down probably a 100K balloon. And so how do you think, if we compare force ratio, that the idea of continued attack, assuming that this is not over in a week, how do they compare in terms of our ability to sustain continued operations? Are we in trouble there?
We are in trouble there. And there was an interesting comment by somebody in the Navy. It wasn't the CNO, but it was fairly significant in the Navy. They were talking about the Chinese shipbuilding. China now is the number one shipbuilder in the world, and in fact builds about 50% or maybe a little bit more of all of the new ships being built for use around the world by everybody, tankers across the board. And part of that shipbuilding is also building naval combatants. And they don't have big, they only have three aircraft carriers, or I guess there are two built and one about to come out. We have 12. And the number of ships that they have in the Navy now on a hull basis exceeds that of the U.S. Now, that's not throw weight of shells and a bunch of other interesting stuff like that. But it is, the numbers themselves have a significant value. They're useful. The reason I bring that up is really is to address the question that you have. If the Chinese were to go to war and it ends up being a sustained operation, etc., they have the ability to shift all of that shipbuilding that they have been doing for commercial purposes, of which the majority of their building right now is, they can shift that almost overnight to put it against building combatants. We have now virtually no shipbuilding capability. Our contribution to worldwide shipping is well less than 1%, if it's even measurable. So we have the shipbuilding capability that we have is the couple or three shipyards that are building submarines behind schedule, building aircraft carriers behind schedule, building destroyers behind schedule. So we have virtually no reserves. We have no way to just shift things over. And I'm only using the shipbuilding example because it's so stark, but the same thing applies place after place, that for a lot of reasons, and not necessarily bad reasons, we shifted so much of our production overseas that we don't have a whole lot of companies that build machine tools. We don't have a whole lot of companies that build all kinds of things that are the component parts of airplanes and so on and so forth. So if suddenly we were on our own, we don't have anything to say, well, we just shift production from automobiles into tanks or airplanes or whatever, the way that Ford did with building bombers. It's a huge, huge problem. And it drives into a couple things, which sort of comes back to the question about time. Ask yourself, how much time do we have? If we got into a war with China, how much time do we have to win? And my guess is that not very much, because we didn't have to go on the offensive the day after Pearl Harbor, or the day after the German invasion of Poland, or the 1940 invasion of France. We had a year or so, and we'd already started. So we could build up an enormous amount of stuff. That capability is not zero, but it's significantly lacking. Whereas on the other hand, the Chinese, because by what they've done, now have an enormous ability, especially if they are not being attacked in any kind of a serious way strategically. They have an enormous ability to continue building that stuff. They've got 1.5 billion people, which they can come in and shift them from one thing to another, train them, recruit them, order them into service, whatever. So they probably have a huge advantage in a prolonged war that we simply don't have. Mm-hmm. And we could build it, but probably not in the course of time of war, where we could build that up, go on the offensive, end up defeating China before that we're in a hopeless position for a variety of other reasons. And that's even assuming that everybody says, well, we're not going to hit each other's homelands. We're just going to choose some spot in the Pacific and we're just going to go at it.
Coming back from AFA, looking at a lot of the vendors, speaking to them, and given your more recent background in business strategy, one of the vendors that's always kind of impressed me is Anduril. They assume risk on their behalf. And so what happens is, instead of waiting to be tasked with a problem or given a problem by our acquisition systems, by our U.S. government, they try to discover the problems and then bring solutions. And for a business, that is an assumption of a lot of risk that can absolutely blow up. And somebody's mentioned to me in the past that it would be useful if our capitalistic society would drive businesses to assume some of the risk. So for instance, F-35s, there's no F-35 sitting in a warehouse still owned by the company ready to sell. They build them on demand. And that creates this lack of reserve unless the government itself orders them all. So that there's no drive in our capitalistic society for the business to assume all of that risk. And so I'm just curious on your thoughts on that. There are some businesses out there doing it on a small scale. Why are the businesses so hesitant to take that risk? I think the answer is obvious, but I just thought I'd dive into that.
It's a very interesting question. Paradoxically, It's not because the capitalist system isn't working. It's because it's designed to work exactly the way it is working. So just as an example, I had Assistant Secretary of the Air Force fairly recently very proudly saying that the acquisition of the B-21 was designed to be Congress-proof. I think that was the wording that was used. And what that meant was that there would only be enough built per year at a low enough price that the Congress simply wouldn't cut it off. It wasn't a big ticket item. Okay, cut off the B-21s and then you can buy something else that you would like to have. But this had some very interesting consequences. The interesting consequence of that is that the builder of the B-21 has absolutely zero ability from both a financial standpoint as well as from a business standpoint to build excess capacity. So I don't know the details of the F-35 acquisition, and it wasn't quite the same, but to win that contract, they had to bid a certain amount for the airplanes, and they had to make profit. So if you buy two sets of jigs where one set of jigs would be sufficient, then you have an expense on the second set of jigs that now goes into the price that you are bidding, and now you don't win the contract. A lot that we have done within the defense acquisition regulations have driven companies to do this. And then we don't want to forget that we had a Secretary of Defense early in the Clinton administration that basically called everybody together and said, okay, there are 10 of you out here now or whatever the number was, and there's only going to be two downstream. We just can't afford to have all of you. So there's going to be this huge consolidation. And in fact, that it happened in part driven by the government and in part by just economic things and an assumption that the world was going to be peaceful forevermore. And we have done things that have made it very, very difficult to develop any kind of an excess capacity, in part because of the complexities of the equipment that we have. Even if we had more manufacturing in the United States, to swing that over into these very complex things that take highly trained workforces and maybe take years really to develop and maintain, so that people put bolts on the doors of airplanes that are going to be flying around. That sort of stuff happens, but it is less likely to happen if you have a highly trained workforce, which takes a long time to produce and so on and so forth. I think that the only way that you can really do that, well, there are a couple of things. One of them, it comes back to the time. When the war starts, I don't think we can count on having any build-up time for a whole lot of reasons. One, because they might be dropping bombs on whatever plants that we're building, or shutting off the electricity, or shutting off the gas pipelines, et cetera. Our only hope on this is that we say, okay, this is a crucial national security problem. We need to start working on it right now. And then we start figuring out ways that we can afford. We got to be able to afford it. Figuring out ways that we are going to be able to develop that capacity to go into a surge production when the war starts, if we have the opportunity to do it. I mean, it can be done. There's a lot of things that can be done, but it's going to take time. And if we want reasonable assurance that we're going to survive, and that really, for the first time in a couple hundred years, are we going to survive becomes a real question. It's not merely, are we going to win? Because we got to survive first and think about that. The challenge is just extraordinary. And so much of the stuff that we learned in the past and that we had, we deliberately discarded or simply have not followed up on it because it would never happen again, a variety of other things of that sort. So.
Yeah. Excellent. I appreciate you following me down that rabbit hole. I think it further pulls apart this assumption to the past and the idea that this is a much bigger problem. And I do truly believe that higher levels, that our leadership is getting this, but I think through the force, sometimes it's just a matter of, okay, open the app, continuing to do everything we can to open this aperture, because innovation, adaptation, these are all going to happen and have to happen at every echelon. We can't just top-down driven changes certainly work, but they're not the complete story. So hopefully we're getting at that. We've talked a lot about force and we dipped a little bit into time. I want to talk a little bit about space. And I think as I've watched over just the last few years, if we look at things just as simple as OAR, the Kabul airlift, we start to see the seams and how this sectional view of the world really starts to cause significant problems. And you're bringing up the homeland is something we need to secure. this isn't just an Indo-Pacific problem. And I see that if we look at the Cold War, there wasn't just U.S.-Russia. We had issues all across the globe. So I don't know that we're necessarily, at least among my peers, we're doing a good job of thinking globally of this as a problem. So that's what I see inside the space. As you look geographically at this, how do you see this stacking up?
It's useful to try to think about how can you sort of define the problem at the sort of the highest practical, call it strategic level, if you will. Then you can begin to come down. If you start from where you are now and start to make incremental change, no telling where you're going to end up, and you're probably not going to be addressing the real problem. A way to think about what you just brought up is what geographies, spaces can we think of that could be decisive in a war with China? I can think of two. One of them is right here, and one of them is right there, on the other side of the world. Is it going to be won or lost in Indo-Pacific over Taiwan? If we lost Taiwan for some period of time, does that mean the United States is doomed? I don't think so. I can't think of any geographical area that is decisive other than from our offensive standpoint, China, and from our survival defensive standpoint, the United States. So if in fact that that's accurate, then you start saying, okay, let's suppose we were starting fresh with our command structure. How would we design it? This is a very, very difficult and a complex question, but it would be very difficult to say, well, we're going to put 15% of our forces in Europe, and we're going to put 15% in South America and 15% over here. And then we're going to give each one of those individual commanders an ability significantly to influence what the United States is doing. What does the sink need? The sink of what? Mm-hmm. And what is the role in the war going to be? So you probably would come up with something significantly different than what we have. The conceptual approach to it really is to say, okay, here's the problem. Now, what is the ideal solution to that problem? And then when you develop that, you might look at that and say, for domestic political reasons and a whole variety of other things, we simply can't have that. I mean, it might be a general staff and a military commander, a five-star, a six-star, something like that. That might be the answer. I'm not sure that it is at all. Is that politically saleable in the United States? Well, after the bullets start flying, probably yes, but before then, probably not. What do we have to modify with this ideal solution that, in fact, becomes politically feasible, economically feasible, and so on, doable? And it probably comes in that you end up keeping some of the existing structure simply because it's too hard to do away with it. National Guard structure, for example, which I suspect is invaluable. But if you try to do away with that for one reason or another, all of a sudden you have 48, 50 states that are saying, oh, not on my watch. Yeah. And so it's infeasible. You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't want to spend the energy to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's that thinking down process. And I think that that's the thing that a place like Air University and Maxwell Air Staff can be absolutely invaluable, is to start thinking about that stuff. And you say, well, that's not the business of the Air Force to figure out what national organization is going to be. Well, if you're going to be fighting underneath it, it is certainly your business to figure out what would be ideal, what you want to fight under, and then do your best to see if you can't get somebody to agree with you.
I'm a big proponent of doing it at that level. I mean, we can't assume that Hap Arnold or Billy Mitchell didn't have any ideas until they got rank, you know? I mean, that's it's significant.
A good way to put it.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about that in Comrail. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about. It's been said ad nauseum on space. Just the vastness of the Indo-Pacific theater is huge.
Let me stop you on that for just a second.
Oh, okay.
You know, we keep coming back and talking about the Indo-Pacific theater. If by Indo-Pacific theater, if you mean China, that's fine. But when you say Indo-Pacific theater, the image that comes to mind is a bunch of ships that are sailing around and some islands, Taiwan, Guam, and so on and so forth, which are all interesting, but they may not be especially apropos to solving the China problem. So the language and how we think about that, it's not an Indo-Pacific problem, it's a China problem.
I guess I make my own point there, that a lot of times the tendency to put things into blocks is overwhelming.
Existing blocks.
Absolutely. In interest of time, let's talk about time. I've heard you talk quite a bit about unrestricted warfare, a book written and translated that talk a great deal about how it influences the Chinese strategy and how they think about time. And I think that's something we should definitely talk about here to kind of pull apart. They've studied a great deal of your work and others' work from the Gulf War. So maybe a little bit of how the Chinese think of time should influence how we approach its strategy.
There's another interesting thing here. It's popular to say, and I think that there's some truth in it, although I'm not quite sure it's as much as we think it is, that the Chinese think in centuries and so on and so forth. Maybe they do, but in the real world, thinking in centuries is interesting, but you also got to be thinking right now. So if you fought a war, for example, you have a century-long objective, and you fight a war and you're beaten tomorrow, then your century-long objective is no longer relevant. So there are two aspects of the time. The one is sort of the grand vision of what you want. So the grand vision for China, I think, really is to restore what the Chinese thought that they had up until about 1500 and 1600. They considered themselves to be the Middle Kingdom, which was the kingdom of the world, and everybody else was a vassal state. They even sent a letter to the King of England asking, basically, when are you going to send tribute to me? And wording the letter like he was a vassal, somebody who was from Vietnam or someplace like that. Do people want to restore that sort of stuff? And we say, oh, well, that's ridiculous. It isn't ridiculous because we're talking about a culture and a way of thinking that is so dramatically different than ours that you just can't assume that anything that we think is ridiculous, they think is ridiculous. Two aspects of time. So one, there's sort of that big scope time, and then the other is the wartime. And I believe, talking about unrestricted warfare, et cetera, one of the things that the authors of that book came out with right up front was they made the comment that the Gulf War changed the world and ultimately the very nature of war itself. So if you say that, then you've got to assume that they have done the other kind of work to understand, well, what really went on in the first Gulf War and so on. And if I think about that, there are a lot of interesting observations about the first Gulf War that can be used. A lot of them at a tactical level, the value of stealth and so on and so forth, precision. But I think that at the highest level, that two things that really stand out is, one, the concept of parallel war. In other words, making a lot of things happen in a very short period of time. And correlated with that is, what is a short period of time? And the actual clock time is going to vary, obviously, with the circumstances. But you can put it in terms of saying that from an attacker standpoint, the ideal is to do enough to your opponent in parallel that you paralyze your opponent at a strategic and at an operational level, if that's necessary, which it may or may not be, but at a strategic level, extraordinarily useful to do it. And that amount of time to impose paralysis is basically one where you force enough impacts, enough effects on the opponent that they start making it impossible to organize and to fix things that are going wrong or to do counteroffensives or anything else. And in the Gulf War, you got the essence of that probably in 4 or 5 hours, in the first 4 or 5 hours. It started that process. Now, if you'd quit right then the Iraqis would have recovered very nicely and could have fixed everything that was broken and taken them a month or two and probably continued the war effectively. But if you continued it, and it was probably by the third week of the war, that Iraq was simply not functional at a strategic level. And I think one really classic example of that is that when Saddam became desperate, said, this is just not going the way it's supposed to. We've got to have this big battle. So he wants his army in Iraq to launch an offensive. And he has some ideas about what that's going to be. So did he pick up the phone and call the Army Corps commander? No, why not? Phones didn't work. Anyway, they would be intercepted by the Americans. Okay, what can I do? Well, I don't want to just entrust this to sending a guy on a motorcycle or something like that. I've got to go myself. So he actually put a small convoy together, a half dozen cars, and then drove from Baghdad down to near Kuwait City in order to meet with his senior commanders to plan what became the Battle of Kafji, which was a disaster for the Iraqis. That's an interesting story in itself. the fact that he had to do something extraordinarily dangerous and unlikely to succeed. In fact, it almost didn't, because there was an F-16 guy that was flying over someplace over the road where the convoy was coming down. He saw the convoy and he called in to AWACS or whatever, back to the AOC or whatever, wherever, and said, "Hey, this is down here. Can I shoot it?" And they said, "Well, we need to get more information on it." No, it turned out to be Saddam. So if that guy had just gone ahead and done mission type orders, if there had been good ones, then the war would have ended in a probably much sooner and in a dramatically different way. But that, I think, is a pretty good example of the fact that there was strategic paralysis.
You've talked a lot about the defense of the homeland here, and can we build a hypothetical strategic paralysis here in the United States to really kind of emphasize that? Hypothetical, whether they have the capability or not, what would cause strategic paralysis here?
Well, so this is a matter of interest. We have recently, within the last couple of weeks, developed a 9-minute video, which is called Notional War Against China. And it's strictly a focus on a potential Chinese attack. And so it involves biological, it involves cyber, it involves EMT. Interesting, too, you know, who knows, talking about an alliance between the Russians and the Japanese, if that report that came out yesterday is somewhat accurate as it's being portrayed, that the Russians maybe have described as a nuclear anti-satellite device. Well, it might be anti-satellite device, but it also may be an EMT device. So EMT, cyber attack, sabotage attack, and et cetera, all of which, if it happens within a 24-hour period, will in fact put the United States into a hopeless position. Jim Woolsey was the head of the CIA when, in the first part of the Obama administration, I think, if I'm remembering the dates right. He testified afterwards in 2017 to Congress, and he was talking about the impact of the shutdown of electricity in the United States. He said there are two possibilities. He said if electricity was shut down, in he kind of described how, not a nuclear attack, he said it would take potentially years to get it back into operation. And he said if it would shut down for a year, 90% of the people in the United States would die. So that's scenario number one. Scenario number two is 100% would die. That alone is strategic paralysis. So are we vulnerable? Yeah. And he was not talking about some hypothetical impossible thing. He was actually testifying about some hard facts of physics. And in fact, the things that we're doing right now are not helping to make our grid any stronger. In fact, that they're driving in exactly the opposite direction. So can they do it? Yeah, maybe tomorrow morning, literally.
Definitely changes some assumptions. We don't want to be overly dim and grim, but we still need to appreciate it.
We need to think about it. If we continue to go along in our Pollyanna world that everything is fine and we're here and nobody would dare attack the United States because they'd be afraid that we would respond with nuclear weapons, then we remember what Mao said. You know, not afraid of nuclear war. So we lose half of the population, 300 million people. We still have 300 million left. What's the problem? This is a different group than what we have dealt with before.
Absolutely. So you've looked at this. We've done some analysis here at the top level, attempt to change the way in which we look at this. So as you begin to look at it, what are some of your big points, your big advice to strategists to tackle this problem? What are your big points? What do we absolutely have to do?
Well, I would say for anybody, regardless of what their current rank is, from the very bottom to the very top, is one, open the mind and think about what the challenge is. Then I think that what you need to do basically is you need to flip your thinking and say everything that I thought of before strategically, et cetera, is no longer valid. Now, let me start thinking about how to deal with the thing. Then the second thing you say is you've got to accept the reality that China is a peer competitor and it's unique. And there may not be a war. We certainly hope that there isn't going to be a war, but I do not allow us to lose. We are going to win. And that's the start for the thinking process. And then you start going through, so what would that mean? Well, it means that, first of all, it starts off with that our objective is to defeat China. It's not to deter China. You have no idea what it would take to deter, if they're even deterrable. Our objective is to defeat China, which, incidentally, if they are convinced that we can defeat them, that might deter them, might. Then the second thing is, okay, in a very broad sense, what does that mean? And it means unless that we are willing to do a first strike, which is highly unlikely, we've got to survive an attack from China. So we've got to defend the United States to the point where we can continue to function and function effectively. And then we have got to launch a counteroffensive, be capable of launching a counteroffensive that then defeats China. Now, let's figure that out, and then you get back into all the questions about what's the doctrine for that. I don't know whether current doctrine manages that or not. Organization, command structure, where we're putting our emphasis, mobilization, all the rest of those things, you start thinking about them. Okay, we got a new set of problems. We can learn from some things we did in the past, but everything we think about has got to be related to this really big problem. We did that as an Air Force and as a military and as a country. Some people might say, well, you prepare for war against China, and if that never happens, why then what do you do when there's a little war? If you can defeat China, you can win any little war that you want to win. So, well, what about Taiwan? Whoever wins the big war owns Taiwan. So that's my advice.
Before you said that, it occurred to me that you've mentioned Taiwan twice in our hour-long discussion here. I think I've heard you say in the past that may be a little bit of a distraction.
It may ignite the conflagration, but it's not going to be the place where the war is decided, regardless of what happens there.
Right, which goes back to your previous point, two geographies, the two locations. That's interesting. So we've got a lot of information for you, and I think we all have a lot to think about. I'd like to maybe here in closing give you an opportunity, a little more less directed question. One of the things that kind of stands out to me is coming back from AFA is a very passionate statement by our secretary that says, we are out of time. We are out of time. China, China, China. We are out of time. We got to get moving. We got to accelerate. Chief Staff Alvin discussed a lot about, hey, we don't have these 100% figured out, but we have to change now. And so started making big changes without a full roadmap for all of them. So we have to change. And so in your experience, not just building a strategy to win, but a large part of business strategy is strategy to change. And so how do I change and get oriented to this? So what advice do you have for our leaders, for our airmen, and not only thinking strategically, but also building this speed, building this time, getting ready for change? What would you tell in charge of your wing? What would you be telling your leaders right now?
The kinds of things that you can do at a wing level are the kinds of things probably Secretary and Chief talking about. But they were all focused on the Indo-Pacific, Taiwan kind of a thing, which pretty traditional. We're going to assemble, deploy, fight, sustain, win, or quit, and then come home. And you certainly want to be able to do that. The ability at a wing level to prepare for the larger war is a significantly different kind of a thing. Although there probably are some things that you can do. So if you are the first wing at Langley, it would be interesting to just have some discussions with some of your key people and say, okay, suppose that we don't deploy to Taiwan, but in fact that we're attacked here. What do we do? What could we really do? How could we put things together? How can the base survive? How might it be attacked? Suppose there's no communication. How do we deal with that sort of a thing? You know, right now, if you have a recall, pick up the phone and it all works. And I know that years ago, at any rate, we practiced or we talked about doing a no-com recall. But I don't remember that ever being actually exercised because it just took too long. It'd take hours and hours or maybe days to go to everybody's house and say, hey, you know, you need to come and so on. So that kind of stuff can really be done. So you could put yours and you can do it without any significant expense or anything else. But it's just that's okay. So what can we do? Because this could happen tomorrow. And if it does, how are we going to react? Because the instructions, we may not get any instructions from up here. They may simply not exist. So are there sort of the things that mission type orders is okay, if Langley, if I'm the first TIE fighter wing commander and I don't have any communication with Washington or with the numbered Air Force, what am I going to do? Okay. you have to give it some thought. Yeah. And, you know, what I just mentioned were a handful of little ideas. They may be good, they may not be. Hmm. But if you sat down and kind of made that something that you do once a month or every couple months and just spend 4 or 5 hours sitting around talking about it, you'd probably come up with a whole lot of things that would be interesting. And if everybody did that, the wing here, the National Guard guys here with the F-35s, go through that same kind of an exercise at that level, what you might be able to do, but at a still higher level, is you start thinking about, okay, suppose that I were with the chief of staff or the secretary of defense or the president, how would I manage this war with China? And let me think through it. What would the strategy be? How would I want to use my forces and all that whole variety of things? And you come up with a bunch of ideas. And if nothing else, that you say, hey, we got a serious problem. And when you are having conversations with your superiors, with people that work for you, whatever, you say, hey, you know, let's all be thinking about this problem because there's a new world here. And let's build as much support for it as we can within our own organization, within the Air Force, within the Department of Defense, within the Joint Staff, et cetera.
Well, yeah, really opening the aperture. Thank you so much for being here. Just as a final thought, if you had to pick one question you wanted our audience to be asking themselves as the podcast is coming to an end here, what would that be?
The most serious question I think that anybody can ask themselves is, do I believe that China is a peer competitor? And if your answer is no, well, then you don't have to worry about anything. I mean, it's easy. I mean, we can go fight Taiwan anyway. We might win, we might lose, but we know how to go there and fight. You can do it better or worse, but we know how to do that. If you say, yeah, I do believe that, then that automatically launches you into an entirely new set of thinking and internal debate and debates with your associates, etc.
That's going to do it for this week's podcast. This show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach section. Special thanks to Colonel Warden, the LeMay Center, and Air University. As always, the views expressed by our guests and hosts are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. I'm Nicholas Underwood. We will see you next time.